In 1874, the British government passed a series of laws called the Regulation of Public Worship. A lot of people cared an awful lot about church back then.
True.
On one side, people wanted more ritual and ceremony.
Order.
On the other side, they wanted mostly none.
Yeah.
In the midst of the battle, one minister, a rector in London at a church called St. George in the East, had stopped a practice whereby people who volunteered in church services could avail themselves of liquor from the rector's cupboard before and after the service. The Reverend King closed the cupboard. We have opened it again. Welcome to the rector's cupboard.
Order!
This week on Rector's Cupboard, we are pleased to offer a collaboration with our good friend, David Goa. David has been recording conversations with pastors, theologians, and other interested people about the Christian church, which David refers to as the Ecclesia, and asks, who is she? We recorded some of these conversations with David in the beginning of 2022. You can go back and listen to them if you'd like. They're called The Church in Between Times. David recently asked if he could speak with us at Rector's Cupboard about the church. This episode is a recording of that conversation between David and Todd. Enjoy, and thanks for listening.
It's great to see you, Todd. You and I and Allison, we did a series of conversations with various people that you knew in the Vancouver area, mostly evangelicals, Reformed as well, on the Ecclesia. Who is she? What do we make of her? And you and Allison and your group, you have been engaged in a large body of work, which I think you call Evangelically Departed.
Oh, yeah, that's the little newsletter that I write.
Yes. And so I wanted to have a conversation with you and just hear your thoughts on what you see as having gone on in the evangelical world and where get your sense of the measure of it at this point. So to begin, maybe we can do this in sort of three parts.
Sure.
One is you and I know each other well enough. We've talked a fair bit. And I know that we, at least I think we share a deep regard for what the evangelical tradition within the ocean of Christianity has historically meant. It's such a beautiful word, that Greek word. And of course, we have a lovely word in Old English, which, and this is rare, mirrors it perfectly, the word gospel, both of which mean good news. And so I know that you and I have some regard for what that has meant and certainly what it has meant in our own formation. And at the same time, I guess both of us have been saddened or concerned about what has happened to that word. I know in some research that the Pew research folks have done indicates that the word evangelical now is claimed by so many as a kind of political identifier. A large percentage of people that say they are evangelicals do not attend church. They might do something on Zoom or mostly go to YouTube or something of the sort. But there's been a huge shift here that's occurred. And then recently, of course, Tim Alberta has written I think quite interesting and thorough examination in his book, The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, Evangelicalism in a Time of Radical Politics. But I'd like to begin with you. I'd like to begin on healthy and good ground.
Yeah.
So could you begin by just saying a little bit to us about your own, what you see as the gifts of the evangelical world and what they've been for you and how they have shaped your mind and your heart and your disposition. And then perhaps tell us a bit about why you began this work associated with the evangelically departed.
Mm-hmm.
How so many evangelicals of your generation perhaps have moved to the side, and we'll talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
So your own sense of the good news.
Thanks, David. It's easy for me to speak of the gifts of the evangelical world for me personally. Even, you know, in the kind of play on words, evangelically departed title, and the kind of things that exist now within some of the evangelical and post-evangelical culture that people have come out of. So even as I kind of look at evangelical culture and my experience of it, the thing that I feel the most, and I don't know that this would always be obvious in what I write and say, but the thing that I feel the most is gratitude. I am grateful for the evangelical heritage that has been and continues to be very formative in my life, socially, culturally, religiously, spiritually. It's still, in a sense, the world that I see as my world, you know, like these are my people. These are the, and largely when I think of it, I think I'm so grateful for people who took an interest in me, helped me to do things like read, which has changed my life, study, take my faith seriously. My coming to faith, if you were going to kind of describe evangelical experiences, you know, conversion experience and these kinds of things. So I realized it at a young age, like a teenager and in my 20s, and then I started working in evangelical churches. But I realized right early on that, oh, okay, the way you come to faith in this is you go up to an altar call of some kind at camp or at, but as I look at my own conversion, that's not what I would count as kind of the time of conversion. It was more kind of supernatural than that. And without that kind of dressing, like here's how you do it. You pray this prayer and you do these things. And yet I found myself immersed in that world. And so that feeling of gratitude for, I wouldn't have, it is how I came to know, how I put it in like evangelical terms, how I came to know Jesus and who Jesus is, what I believe Jesus has done for me and all others. So how it shaped my disposition then, I think then some of the ways that I looked at evangelicalism, even the 30 years that I was more immersed in it, like a pastor in an evangelical church, and I was always kind of an outsider, even within the system, because I didn't have a family that, like, I wasn't going to church with my parents at an early age. I wasn't part of that kind of social hierarchical system. And so even as someone who was learning and studying and then being employed and then eventually becoming a pastor within that system, I was always kind of observing from the outside at the same time. And now loving these people and loving the culture, for the most part, I also was able to go like, oh. And so I recall one time as a young Christian being in a Baptist church that I was attending at the time, and seeing in the foyer, the narthex, whatever it'd be called, right? They'd say foyer. So this is the first time there's these postings of like a bulletin board about abortion, and I didn't really know what abortion was at the time, and homosexuality. And so I started to learn, oh, these people, which I'm a part, but these people have these things that are really, really important to them, these political things. And I think then what happened through the years, I was able to kind of have a critical eye as well, even in the culture, the people that I loved. And the I think eventually it came to the point where I realized through my own study and through everything else, so this is the story of so many people. There's a whole world out there in terms of Christian faith that is not like evangelicalism, meeting people like you. Hearing how in some evangelical circles, the Catholic Church was spoken about, or there mostly wasn't even a concept of Orthodox tradition. And certainly to be Christian meant to be evangelical. And so then I started to, there's people who see this differently. There are people who see things even like, you know, what it means to be saved or salvation differently. And so I hope, I don't mean to assume it, but I hope that I'm able still to, I know that I'm grateful for that heritage, but I hope that I'm able to kind of look back and go, I wouldn't be who I am without it, good and bad, I suppose. But I want to speak about faith in a way that is much more expansive than my experience. And so now I realize, because I still have relationships with many people within that culture. And there is at times, even though like you might have a very loving relationship and respect for one another, but I'm definitely one of those people now that's like, oh, don't know if you're fully part of the program anymore. Like you're not speaking in exactly the same kinds of ways, right? But I hold that gratitude. And I think positively of now. I would say that's easy for me. I was a young white male pastor who was, you know, could preach. And so I didn't experience much of the difficulty, pain, and even I would say oppression that some people experience. That so for me it was an easier story than for some. So but that gratitude remains.
It makes a difference, it seems to me, if one develops, as one matures. So often when we grow up, or at least I think some of us, when we grow up, the church of our childhood is a kind of womb, and it nurtures us. And then when we begin to study and have other kinds of experiences, discover the larger world, so many of my generation experienced their churches so unsatisfactory when they were 15 or 16. and so they fled it. And I've often thought that if you take your adolescent self literally around religion, you might wake up when you're 40 years old realizing that you took your adolescent self literally. And that in fact, there's a huge difference in actually maturing within the body of whatever one's particular church is, and realizing that it is part of the world. And the church is a wonderful thing, in part because of its difficulties and warts and what it means to live together. So your gratitude has remained, and that's one of the reasons, of course, that I appreciate you so much, because it gives you a different way of thinking about others who remain within a particular kind of evangelical world.
You've helped us a great deal with, so if when I hold this gratitude then, and yet I want to be honest about my own faith and learning, and that word I use is expansive in terms of, oh, this other Christian faith tradition doesn't see this as I was taught. There's a difference here that's key. You've helped us. I think it was your father that said most people are better than their theology. And that, I mean, it's a nice little funny kind of saying too, but it's also consoling to me, because I realized that the people I was living with, and I don't want to put myself above them by any means, right? Like, oh, I'm so learned and I know, and they don't. But there was that, one of the things is I love them so much. I'm so grateful for them, Oh, but they were given a theological frame that was very much, you know, these are the classic kind of us and them, divisive, often fear dominated. What's remarkable is how well they did within that frame, how well they loved people, how much they welcomed people like me. Welcoming people like me, not only to the point of caring for me, but trusting me to speak to them as if I had something to say. So some of those things help. Then the comment on spiritual adolescence, I think, is one that I still play with and resonates with me. That, and you speak about spiritual adolescence a fair bit, like, and like codependent twins of, that you speak about. And but the spiritual adolescence piece, as a pastor, then I pray about this often, because I'll hear, often I see it expressed in nostalgia, like a nostalgia for a time that maybe never existed, or a nostalgia for, you know, oh, we used to be able to pray in schools or something. Like, you'd often get political tags that, and I see today in evangelical circles, because I still work in evangelical churches, not full time in any capacity, in that capacity, but I see nostalgia connected to that spiritual adolescence now, where the, to some degree, the 40-year-old, you know, didn't necessarily wake up, but they still hold their faith. They still, so I don't want to say that as like, you know, grab their shoulders and shake them and say, why don't you grow up? I don't know if that would be the right thing to do, but I do long for more thoughtful engagement.
Usually doesn't work all that
Yeah,
well for parents with their 13-year-old son.
it's interesting, right?
So, not likely to work in other contexts either. So you have, you and Allison and your team, you have continued to work largely within the evangelical world, and you've given, if I understand correctly, you've given some quite special attention to people from the evangelical world who, and I want you to describe this for me. I guess I would just say it seems to me people in the evangelical world that have come to a place where they at least think they've outgrown it. Or perhaps it's come to a place where some of the social and cultural, political preoccupations within evangelical churches, they have found those difficult to take on board, so they've stepped aside of the community. Can you, am I right in describing it this way? Can you
Very
describe
much,
to me
very
what
much.
you've seen within the kind of, I mean, I view this as part of, whether I should do this or not, but it seems to me that part of your vocation is a kind of ministry to the evangelically departed, as you've called them. Can you just walk around that a little bit? And who are they? What do you see going on there? What's trying to be born in that?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I feel is, and again, this is, I mean, I came across it in your writing and speaking, but I think it's Reinhold Niebuhr. Anything worth doing can't be accomplished in your lifetime.
Yeah.
And then that's why we need faith, this call that, and I think, I don't know if this is just a cop out so that I don't feel too driven or trying to build an empire or something, but I think whatever is happening won't be accomplished in my lifetime. Or, and I do see times of upheaval and transition. And so your question is to like who we connect with and who, as in all these things, there's some variation in that. I mean, the kind of brutal name that some would give to some of the work we do, they would put us in a camp that they call deconstruction, right? And some of those voices that are very firmly ensconced in some ways of seeing things would then warn against, you know, deconstruction. And we don't see ourselves as people who hold deconstruction as a goal or virtuous, or, but at the same time, we're mindful of the fact that the various people who connect with us, there is something like that going on for many of them. So they're different. There might be a younger person who didn't grow up in some of the more rigid ways of seeing things, but given some of the things happening culturally in the world, given some of the history of the church as they see it, there's kind of a fairly harsh deconstruction going on and a bit of a walking away. But then it's interesting to me, many of the people we connect with are not necessarily younger people. What I mean is these would be people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, who, as I see them and seek to work with them and, you know, care for them, and we care for one another, feel through work like ours and others, other people that they might read or listen to, that there is a safe place for them to say, I'm not sure about how I've believed, and yet my faith still really matters to me. And they see us as helpful in describing, oh, okay, so you have this belief, let's say in David, use a concept from the evangelical world like the rapture. So this idea that all faithful Christians will disappear, connected with dispensationalism and views of end times, as the evangelicals would say, right? You know, to use, it's really kind of a stark example, but there are many people we work with that in their growing up, they would take a concept like the rapture to be on par with the gospel in terms of this is what the Bible says, this is what the, so they come across people like us who then say, okay, do you know where that came from? Do you know that was like 1800s? Here's this, you know, in other words, most of Christian history in terms of time, but then even present day, most Christians don't hold that belief. And then it becomes, I guess, liberating for them, but maybe challenging as well, because then we can see it in people's eyes and in conversation. And, oh, if I give this up, am I giving everything up, right? I often think that, you know, those ancestry DNA type kits, you find out where you came from, who you, I'd love to have like a theological DNA kit, yeah, where you could, and I feel this is a pastoral thing, where you could be like, oh, let me just run these tests here and see what, oh, I can see why you're, or at least, you know, I can kind of see why you think that. Oh, it's because you come from these people. And I don't mean that in a negative way, right? Like to condemn. I mean, oh, I can see. So I think groups like ours, and I think of the work of people like Brian Zond in California and others who still clearly have the desire to speak about Christian faith from their Christian faith, but are doing so in a way that is doing some of this work of like, oh, it's okay to see things differently. But I'm also willing to obviously to be misunderstood, right? To have people say, oh, they're just about tearing things down, or they're just about that. I don't feel that I am. And then in terms of church involvement, you're asking about like actually, you know, people connected to church, going to church. The landscape is just so like volatile right now that an evangelical church that I work at regularly, I've been connected with them for a few years now, and each Sunday that I'm there, I still meet people, and I'm the most consistent preacher at that place, but I'll meet people that in those 3 years I've never met them. In other words, I haven't seen them on one Sunday, but they clearly, and I say this positive, they clearly see themselves as part of that church. They love the church. They're grateful for the people, but they might not have been for 3 years. Now, some churches, not that one, but some churches, they could watch online, as you say, they could. So there's the joke that I use is even people who go to church don't go to church anymore. That there is this kind of, and it's unsettling for people, I think. And yet both churches that I work in consistently, one's a United Church, so mainline background, and the other is an evangelical background church. They're both like healthy. They're both seeing more people come, new people come. So it's an interesting time for what it means for people to be engaged in church as they navigate some of these, I don't know if I believe this way anymore or this thing. I'm also mindful in that of the place of non-belief within belief. The ability for people to be honest in a community and say, I'm part of this community, but I really struggle with my belief in faith. And a lot of times I don't believe this. In my evangelical background, that would have been like, okay, we gotta deal with that. And now there's a bit of, we're glad you're part of this community. And that's part of the nature of faith, is that it ebbs and flows a bit individually.
Isn't that interesting? So you see more people there. You spoke about both those churches as healthy churches.
Mm-hmm.
And many pastors that I've talked with see their churches as quite unhealthy these days, either because there's deep divisions or because they're shrinking and mm-hmm. they see themselves as dying. So they're unhealthy in that way. You describe both these parishes as healthy, and you've suggested that in both of these contexts, the people are more comfortable with uncertainty.
Mm.
Have I understood you correctly?
Yeah, I think most, yeah.
So part of the curious history of evangelicalism and the way in which it is one of the seed beds for fundamentalism mm-hmm. on the Great Plains of the Americas seems to me to have been precisely around wanting to not stare in the face of uncertainty, or what I would prefer the Greek word of mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had the development of the fundamentals written by the Princeton professors 120 years ago, paid for by a couple Texas billionaires, oil billionaires.
Yeah.
And that really had a huge impact on the religious culture of North America. I think it has political impact as well, because that both establishing a deep suspicion mm-hmm. about ambiguity, about uncertainty, and then turning the faith into a set of propositional beliefs, which become the gatekeepers for your particular community. And those, of course, vary in a variety of ways, but there's a central core of them. Mm-hmm. Both of these do something that's so different from what my childhood sense of the evangelical Lutheran church I was part of, which was very evangelical. My sense, and I'd be interested in yours around this, my sense in that childhood part of my life, there certainly was creedal statements, there were moral statements, there was all that sort of thing. But there was also a and I don't think I can describe it more as a kind of feel, a kind of feel for the unfolding of things, and a feel for a sense that even the creedal statements are not properly grasped simply as propositional statements. So when I started reading in the early church fathers and what have you, and realized that the creed was a song, and that when we say, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, that the word believe in Greek means am drawn towards, am staking my life on, it illuminates something for me. That's so different than turning it into a kind of a proposition.
That's you're really helping me right now, and back all the way to the most people are better than their theology. If faith is real, whatever that means, if God is present, we can trust in Jesus Christ, then in contrast to these propositional statements, which again, I have appreciated, they can help in understanding. But in contrast to that, the faith and the living out of faith is always dynamic. And so I think at times, and when I, like what has helped me and kept this sense of gratitude, things as small as, and we've shared this, David, things as small as like a sense of humor. A sense of humor, including to whenever anyone makes a statement, this, here I stand, you know what I mean? Which the evangelical church was a lot of that. I was always able to kind of lovingly giggle at that a little bit too, because I realized that it was, and in my own experience too, but I realized as a pastor caring for people that it was aspirational, but it was stated as like definitive. And so then the gatekeeper stuff comes along, and then people are, you know, divided up as to how much they have made these statements. And of course, in the Plymouth Brethren heritage, of which I'm familiar in the evangelical church, you know, raised Baptist in a Baptist church, not that grew up connected to Baptist church, but then found my way to this Plymouth Brethren church that was more open than the very super rigid Plymouth Brethren. But in the Plymouth Brethren tradition, there'd be no creeds. Like you wouldn't, that was too Anglican or too Catholic or too, but I, you know, obviously you learn early on, oh, there are creedal things here, much more just as rigid and maybe even more so than those other ones. And so I love the word you use, unfolding. And when you talk about being drawn towards, and I think there's still something beautiful about that within the evangelical tradition to affirm, to say, you know, be grateful for these propositional statements in a way, but can we help one another realize the limits of them? That it's not actually how God is present with you. He's not present with you in this stand you're taking, you know. God's presence is this dynamic unfolding. And so I think part of how I experience that in like meetings, so whether it's like a strategic planning meeting, you know, because you're going to set the vision of the church, or it's a prayer meeting. And in the evangelical tradition, the prayer meetings, I don't know how this is in other traditions so much, but the small kind of sitting in a circle prayer meetings tended to include a fair bit of like lament about the state of the world. Oh, things are so terrible. God, protect our children from, you know, all these outside influences. And so whether it's in like strategic planning meeting or prayer meeting type stuff, I sometimes felt myself not as, I didn't feel things were as urgent as I felt other people around the table were feeling them to be.
Interesting.
And I think I would say part of that was actually, and not to denigrate their faith, but part of that is like, I actually believe this stuff. not saying they don't, but I believe this. I have faith in Jesus Christ. I have, and so I'm not as...
You're more confident.
Yeah. And so that's now back to our work. You use that word that on the pastoral level, use the word confidence. On a pastoral level, that kind of faith that is demanding those propositional statements and dividing the world up into who has made them and who has not, what stances have we taken? And it's, we've got to have this stance on this issue, whether it's whatever social issue of the day. I've experienced in my own faith and my own living with people in church communities, I've experienced that faith as less confident, not more. Mm-hmm. So while I've been helped by those people, I haven't been like, oh, I need to emulate that way of believing. I'm grateful for them, but I think even in honoring them, I will believe differently. So that's, yeah.
Yeah. Some years ago, I revisited some of the early sources on pietism. Because the Pietist tradition coming out of Johann Arndt 100 years after Martin Luther, often thought of as the second Luther, he wrote a book called True Christianity and was really arguing about, I guess, what I would call the kind of raw, I'm not going to even call it an encounter, but the raw sense of the wonder of grace. Yeah, maybe I'll just leave it at that. And I read some of the diaries, and this tradition, of course, had influenced my own family, my father, a lot. So I grew up with it. And one of the things that struck me, particularly when you read some of the diaries of the early pietists, is that they had an encounter. They came to a raw place of being addressed by God, of the wonder of it all. I mean, the language breaks down here, but
yes,
what's clear is that
yeah,
they weren't grasping something. They weren't even given something. They weren't believing something. They were addressed in some way. And that address was, I use the word raw, because so often in their accounts, it spoke into a time when they were genuinely tempted to despair, to give up, to become cynical. These folks, so just let me try this on you.
Sure.
My sense is that they had, I guess, what I would call a kind of elemental experience of being in the presence of grace, which had touched them in a very deep place. The Apostle Paul, of course, gives us the most beautiful account of this. While I was yet in sin,
yes.
While I was yet missing the mark, while I was yet stepped out of the world, while I was in darkness, while I had lost my being, you came to me. The psalmist speaks about this. The pietists then shape religious communities. This happens in Sweden, Norway, places like that. And they come as immigrants to North America. And some of them that came as immigrants had this very elemental experience, which they speak about in their diaries. And they want to shape a gathering, a church. What they realize, of course, when they're in North America is that there's no state church. So they had that struggle back in Europe. But here they can do what they want. Nobody cares. So they end up shaping their own churches, their own little ecclesias. And the moment they do that, they're in charge.
Yes, I'm so with you right
now. They then have children.
Yeah.
And their children are growing up, children of immigrants. And of course, there's an immigrant ethic that exists almost universally, which is a quite puritanical ethic.
Yeah.
And it exists for obvious reasons. If you're an immigrant with relatively few resources and little family and what have you, your children have to behave themselves.
Yeah.
Because if they don't, you know, they're going to take the whole ship down.
Yeah.
So immigrants tend to be quite hyper moralistic. Given that they had this experience, and that this experience in a way becomes a frame for them, the temptation is to abstract it, I think. The temptation is to make it into a pattern,
yeah,
make it into a belief in an abstract way, and insist that people sign on to it. What I wondered about as I looked at that material, you know, and I'd looked at this stuff when I was very young, so it wasn't the first time, but it was striking to me. It doesn't surprise me that somebody like Paul or Augustine would be another example. We have many great examples. The psalmist, David. If you have experiences which bring you into desolation, which brings you to the pit, and then you are addressed by God's grace and pulled forth from the pit. That is, you have experienced rescue. You've experienced salvation. Soterios. You have been rescued.
Yeah.
Because you were so close to the pit or in the pit, the last thing in the world you would want is for your children to be there.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I think so often has happened is people that have this experience are full of gratitude, but also terrified.
Oh, yeah.
That their children might walk into that as well. Now, the odd thing about the Christian tradition, and I don't mean to make this description into the whole of Christian experience, because I don't know about that. I think this happens in many, many ways. But this is one type of religious experience, and it's existentially gripping. And it has really taken hold in America because of the Great Awakening, the other revival movements, which have really shaped so much evangelicalism and fundamentalism.
Yep.
But one of the things that is so vivid to me is how big a temptation it must be for someone who's despoiled their life or come close to despoiling their life, being in a state of the deep temptation to cynicism, the ultimate desolation, who has then been rescued, who has then been spoken to by God's grace in some fashion or another, to then want a moral system to protect their children from ever coming into that state of despair. And in so doing, so I ask you this, in so doing, making faith the encounter, being addressed by grace, not something possible within their framework.
No, that's you've so articulated some like pastoral location where I've connected with people, and I would say it's prayerful. So I'll give you an example. What resonates with me as you say that, as a pastor in a church that had a Plymouth Brethren background, so would have very, you know, clear ideas from their background on heaven and hell and the afterlife and salvation and clear kind of ways of, you know, who is in and who is out. I'm picturing it right now and can feel it pastorally again. Both of these people have since died, but a couple. So they were already older by the time I became the senior pastor or whatever my title was at the church. But I had grown up in that church too. I'd been a teenager there before this happened. So I knew these people and loved them. They were wonderful. Again, these examples of people who gave their life in service to the church and the community, and had, they weren't the insiders in the way of, like, you know, the five or six families that kind of have the power in a church that I think is probably in many places, officially or not. But they were kind of a step removed from that. You know, they were always with those people. They were always with, and they were very appreciative of the fact, at least they would say this out loud to me, you know, at the back of the church after, thank you so much for the way you speak. You're opening my eyes to God's goodness. I feel God's love so much more than I did. This is really helpful to me and, you know, recovering from some of the rigid ways of understanding that I had growing up. But then, so they are now in their 70s or something at this time when they're speaking to me. But then they say, in some way, shape, or form, because this happened multiple occasions with just this couple, but other people as well, then they say, can you pray for so-and-so? And they would name their daughter, who's now, you know, 30-something, 40-something, whatever, because she's not following the Lord. Or she hasn't, they might even have some terror that maybe she didn't really pray the prayer all those years ago at camp when we thought she prayed the prayer. So they have this terror. And I could see it. It was a terror. They would have given anything to just have confidence that their daughter was saved. And of course, what they're experiencing is in their theological frame, that they will be eternally separated from her, that she will be facing some kind of eternal conscious torment or something in their understanding of the afterlife. And so I'm trying to, you know, not get into a theological discussion, but I would find myself saying, you know, we know that God is good, right? And they would right away, yes, like they have such a faith in Jesus. Oh, yes, we know. What would it mean for us to trust in God's goodness even more than in your daughter's, you know, declaration or choice or statement?
Or how you understand it.
Or how you understand it.
Yeah.
It would console them to a point, but I think they still held that. So then, with what you say about being addressed and encountered, the word in Karl Barth's theology that informs a fair bit of what we do, and the word that was translated, but that he used for that often, is the word summoned.
Yeah.
And I think I try to experience it as, obviously I'm entirely grateful for it, but I try to remind myself that not everybody feels this. Mm-hmm. Particularly at times people in and running churches. I do feel summoned. I did have an encounter, a supernatural encounter, and then also feel summoned often on a daily basis. So then I ask myself, and again, I hope to do this pastorally, what if people don't feel that, but yet they were socialized and raised in this frame? Mm-hmm. And I land in two places on it. One is, if I trust so much that, and I would say each person is summoned by God's grace, but if I trust so much that God is addressing us, then do I become lackadaisical in not trying to build, you know, an empire, the church, and then I also become mindful that the people, I'm not saying in the churches I'm working with now, or I'm not even thinking of any particular person in in my background, but just in how systems work, the people who are the most afraid, the people who are the most like, we better damn well build this thing and get people saved, are going to tend to be the ones who build the churches, the institutions, because they feel much more than me, we better get at this, because otherwise our kids are suffering some kind of terrible fate. So I understand that as part of the background of the tradition from which I come. But I hope for something better. I'm just aware that the people who most often find themselves in positions of leadership are often going to be the ones who are the most anxious about outcome. And so I wind up praying, dear God, I say this in my faith, I know I am addressed. I know that I'm summoned. I'm also working amongst people who, and in this culture, the secular culture, whatever you want to call it, who do they know, dear God, that they're summoned and addressed? How can I speak of you in such a way that I may have a part in helping them to see that, but without that fear? And I think for me, the absence of fear means I'm not as, like, what if, you know, if David Goa started a church, we're going to start this little community. Like, it, the people less dominated by the fear tend to be the ones who aren't as intent upon, like, I've got to build this thing. And I know that's a generalization, but I do experience it, right? So I wind up again being grateful within the system, like, and yeah, mindful that I'm going to come across that, and that my way of faith is going to be confounding to people who have experienced that deep angst much, much more. But I love the summoned language. I love the addressed language. I sometimes think, I don't know if this is a cop-out, that there might be a generation, at least in this transition.
Yeah.
But I'm aware that I'm more willing to accept that than people who feel like we can't lose a generation of young people. If we do, the whole thing is shot. I don't feel that. So that's, yeah.
Part of what I hear in your description is the difference between a person who has experienced the summons, experienced being addressed, experienced being called by name, and what they aspire to. And the capacity they then have to be confident in what, in our rich Christian language, we would call the murmurs of the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And those who have a theology that speaks about the eternal and the gravity of this life, and that this life shouldn't be squandered, that has an effect on what spins out into the world and has an effect on what is usually thought of as the eternal. And what seems to me to be a bit of an inflated notion that they're in charge of that, responsible for it.
Do you experience that when you say an inflated notion? Because now I'm thinking of particular people in my life. That doesn't necessarily imply like pejorative.
No.
I can think of people who had an inflated notion, at least as I would describe it, but they were not compelled by, you know, a self-centeredness.
No, right.
They picked it up that
yeah,
you know, what I'm doing and what I'm saying and how I'm helping, like, lead this person to Christ, or like, this matters, you know what I mean? But it's still an inflated notion, I would argue.
Well, I think of, you know, there have been people who've spoken to me about as you know, I've done a lot of work in religions that aren't Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been people that have, evangelicals that have been quite firm when I've spoken, for example, about several people in the Hindu or Sikh or mm-hmm. Buddhist, Jewish, Muslim world who've touched me deeply and who I have deep regard for. They have been very direct in saying, but you have a responsibility.
Yeah.
You have a responsibility to tell them about Jesus Christ and to bring them to Jesus, they've said. And I think they're right. I just think the way they understand it is a little problematic, because I love the text where Jesus Christ says, I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. This is the I am mm-hmm. that we hear spoken to Moses behind the mm-hmm. mountain. So when we think of Jesus Christ as the teacher and model and the rescuer, the savior,
yep.
redeemer of human life, that I am is really important. When we look at the way Jesus Christ was with people, am I able to be that way?
Oh, yeah.
Do I meet the woman at the well?
Yes.
Am I hearing the heart of other people?
Yes.
I am the truth. That's startling. Truth is not an abstraction. It's not an idea. It's a person and a particular kind of relationship mm-hmm. where a heart speaks unto heart. I am the life. This is the eternal life. This is the presence of the kingdom. Right. The presence of the kingdom is there when you are given the gift of presence between whoever it is, and also in your own deepest self.
I was in a prayer meeting, not disclosing prayer items, and this would have been this is evangelical background place, and in one of the person's prayers, this isn't that long ago, doing a bit of the like, dear God, you know, the world's so troubled, help us to stand in our faith and to do, and I don't know this man, it was on Zoom, and but then he just dropped this line all of a sudden where he said, and dear Lord, you know, again on this kind of, used the term wishy-washy, everything's so wishy-washy. And then he literally said, and he was like praying this, he said, as if this was a mark of faith in Jesus, he said, why do we have to care? It's time for us to stop caring what Muslims think. He said like that. And so and this man is a Christian man and seeking to live out his Christian faith. But of course, I'm like, oh, dear God. And I think that's a bit of the impetus you're describing, where people would come to you and almost warn you, like, oh, David, you know, it's one thing to have a friend who's Hindu but you're kind of now getting onto this, like, you're really caring what they think. You better be careful about that. I think that if we go back to that sense of if people were in this system where there was much fear, and there was one of the things I feel sometimes, and I obviously have to be careful about how you say this or if you say it, mostly I don't. Whereas a pastor, I can see the interior struggle in someone. you know, that sense of like, oh, what if my kids, or what if I don't believe properly? If, what if I, and sometimes what I want to say to people, but it would take getting to know them well, and is, you know, for you to believe like you believe and how you want to serve and how you, I totally get that. It can even in some ways affirm it from my perspective. But be careful about foisting this onto others as if, and of course I have to watch that same thing. The it's okay to not believe just like I believe. But of course this implies the presence of a living God that, and you know, you, those, that verse, I am the way, or the statement, I am the way, the truth and the life, in the evangelical tradition, of course, David, as you know, that verse is used to draw a frame of exclusion, because the emphasis is, and even in the cadence of how this is preached often and spoken, the emphasis is actually not on the I am statements. The emphasis is on what is translated in their translations as no one comes to the Father but by me. The emphasis on the, is on the no one, which of course means no one other than, and knowing that text, and when Jesus spoke those words, he had said to his followers before his crucifixion in the Gospel of John, where I'm going, you can't go. I'm going from you. And of course, they're all now bewildered and alarmed and experiencing a kind of despair. And then he speaks those words as consolation. And so when I come to them again, I'm grateful for my evangelical heritage, but I say, you didn't tell me these words were consolation. You told me they were condemnation. And I do want to say, we will encounter Christ in the consolation. So the way I experience it is, may we hear the summons in the reminder that it's okay. In Jesus Christ, all is well. Rather than, may we hear the summons in everything's terrible, we've got a lifeline for you. So that's some of the difference that I experience. But and I know, one of the things that's resonating in my head is an old, like a Sufjan Stevens song that is drawing from Psalms, in that address in the summons, that he woke me up again. Like he woke, I feel that all the time. I don't have anything to say in a sermon, or unless not only do I feel like I was addressed, but that I am being addressed.
The gentleman that you talked about who was praying the way he did, that's giving a testimony to an interior struggle. And he doesn't see it that way, but it's pretty vivid. So all of these ways of expressing fear and alienation are confessions.
Well, yeah.
So from a pastoral point of view, you hear a lot in it. It's a real skill to spend enough time with people in that condition that they can hear what they're saying, as Jesus Christ hears it.
I do believe that. And I think one of the tensions that I feel, and again, not wanting to be from a place of arrogance, you know, like I know and I have this right and they don't, because I don't feel that. But I feel that when I hear something like that, that confessional aspect of this. But this is now a criticism of my evangelical tradition, but I'm willing to state it. Those kinds of statements became virtuous.
Yeah.
And they became understood as the people who truly believe are the ones who are willing to say those kinds of things. And so then for somebody like me holding my Christian faith, where I go, I don't experience any of the presence of Jesus Christ in that statement. I see the fear. It was almost too deep of a well to go there most of the time. And that's okay, I guess, right? But then the downside of that is I feel like, where could I have had potentially more positive influence? Because otherwise the place does take the direction that true Christian faith means, you know, I'm gonna make these statements even more boldly. I thank God for that. And so then a couple things happen, that those people who are willing to do that wind up, I would say as a pastor, confusing that with faith.
Yeah.
And then wind up duplicating it potentially in that. So
yeah. Anywhere. Well, one of the most interesting things I've heard you say this morning is this notion that in the two churches that you serve, people that are coming, some of whom understand themselves as evangelicals, are comfortable enough coming, perhaps even want to, with the knowledge that they're not sure about believing certain things. And of course, that lack of certainty is the gateway to encountering the gospel again. It's part of what I hear you describing, we have this marvelous theological cathedral. Some of them are much smaller than others. But these theological cathedrals, you and I both love theology.
Yeah.
We love theology. But of course, theology is a secondary world.
Amen.
And at its best, it leads us back, always leads us back into the presence of the way, the truth, and the life. Leads us back to Jesus Christ, the anointed one.
Amen.
And to being in God.
You have a clear language of being addressed and summoned, and then this note that people are coming, even but more comfortable with the true nature of belief, which includes disbelief at times. And for some people, I'm realizing as a pastor, for some people that disbelief is more present than the belief, even though they are 10, 20, 30 years part of a community, they're Christian, they say that, you know, but when they're honest, they're able to say to pastors like me, they might feel safer. Most of the time, I don't even really believe. But one of the things I do experience in the community, because I've seen the thing on the flip side, you know, so we talk about the fundamentalism on the right or on the left, which has its own fundamentalism, of course, and is at times in this, and this would be the world of deconstruction and whatever else, that disbelief or doubt or whatever becomes deified, you know, almost like a celebration of not believing. And that's not what I'm talking about at all. And one of the things I feel now seeing actual people coming into a Christian community, even though they're not really certain about their belief or faith, is, I feel this very positively, a longing to be addressed, a longing to be summoned. And now when I have a faith that, to follow on Bart, says we're all summoned.
Yeah.
Now I can minister, I think.
That longing is in the human heart.
Yeah, now I can be like, okay, so, but that is, I'm conscious of the fact of how that is steps away from the way faith was spoken about in my evangelical context. So it's still there. I still owe my faith in many ways to that evangelical background. But the frame is different now. It is seeking to resonate with this longing to be summoned and trusting that they are summoned and addressed. So I really love where the church is at. I don't feel the despair over the state of the church that many people feel. Empires are falling, like church empires are falling, which is tends to be a good thing in terms of faith. And I value in my own personal experience that one is evangelical and one is mainline. These two churches that I work in, they come from different places. But at this point in the history of the church in Canada, it's a gift, I feel, to be able to work in these communities. And in this like work of being evangelically departed, I deeply value not just experiences as a gift, but I'm determined in it to stay rooted in the church.
Yeah.
Because of this collective experience of it's not my faith, it's our faith. It's not my statement of faith. You know, we're saying this together, mindful of the fact that there are people here who don't struggle with doubt as much, and then others who do, we're in this together. Yeah.
Well, in both those congregations, at least at times in the past, I expect they would have sung the Wesleyan hymn based on a psalm. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, the Wesleyan tradition had impacted Methodism, which became part of the United Church. So at some point in the past, they would have both sung those words, you know, as pants the heart for cooling stream, well heated in the chase, so longs my heart for thee, my God, and thy redeeming grace. I suspect, Todd, the reason you feel comfortable and confident is that you hear the murmurs, and those murmurs often are hidden behind particular kinds of faces, but the murmurs are there. So, and they've always been there in the evangelical church as well.
Yeah.
And I pray that they still are.
Grateful. Thank you.
Great to hear you so much.
Blessings to you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Rector's Cupboard is a production of Reflector Project and is hosted and produced by Todd Weeb, Allison Williams, and Amanda Mina. Our Cupboard Master is Ken Bell. Rector's Cupboard is made possible by the generous support of donors. Check out rectorscupboard.ca for past episodes, events, and how you can help fund the podcast. You can also support the podcast by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, which helps other people find us. Thanks for listening.